It's 10 minutes for conversation now. So let me open it up to questions and comments, and also want to invite the panelists. You can also ask questions of each other as well. Yes, and please wait for the mic. This is being recorded, so there's a mic that will find its way up to you. Thank you.
Thank you. This is super exciting, so excuse me if I get red as I ask my question. We're talking a lot about death and life and survival and feeling and essence. Thanks for bringing that word into the last part. And so I just, a question for all the panelists is, how does spirituality or practicing religion fit into this idea of we who feel differently? Thank you.
One of the things that, I don't know if this is on. One of the things that happened within my rehearsal process with Daniel working in the theatrical jazz aesthetic was the process has everything to do with the energy in the room. And Daniel would always describe the work that we did as holy work. And I sort of came to that through unlearning my Christian background and experiencing holy work through this aesthetic. And that had everything to do with a kind of communion with that other inside me that was in communion with these men's stories that had everything to do with putting their words in my body. So it was this holy experience that sometimes knocked me on my feet, sometimes made me laugh out loud for no reason, or left me in a puddle of tears on the floor as it did when we were working with that skeleton a little bit after that. And so it was a kind of this transformative experience working within this aesthetic because it put me outside my comfort zone in many ways, including my own Southern Baptist upbringing. And so that the notion of religion and spirituality took on another dimension for me working within the theatrical jazz aesthetic.
I'll just say something real quick, which is, you know, I kind of talked about why is affect studies been so important in queer studies, and I think I usually tend to think about it as like a really good way to kind of register aspects of the social world, particularly kind of like unfinished revolution. So that's kind of how I think about it. But in a sense, I think you could also read the importance of affect studies, thinking a little bit about what Patrick's saying, read the importance of affect studies as kind of a mode of a way of resisting the sort of secular closure of a certain kind of moment in queer history now. So part of, you know, affect, I think, sort of, you know, that's a kind of way of having a resurgence of something other than sort of just like pure secular discourse. And I guess Emily was talking a little bit about this as well.
I mean, I would also just say that, you know, there is a, Heather just referred to it, a certain queer, secular, but not just queer, secular skepticism towards, or really, let's be honest, contempt of religious people quite often. Mm-hmm. And, you know, rather, it might be much more interesting to think, and I guess this is what I've been working on for a long time, think about the crossing points and the discomforting points of contact between religious and sexual identities, plural, including discomforting points of queer contact between religious communities hostile to homosexuality. So to think, and I love this language of ecstatic resistance, to think about ecstatic forms of being and becoming. And religions, a religious experience, offer us many examples of that. That doesn't tell us anything yet about the ideological uptake of such practices and such experiences. But the substance of the feeling, the stuff of the affect, again, might have a lot more in common with feeling differently than secular, progressive, secular queers often mm-hmm. want to admit. But I think we have a lot to learn from thinking at those intersections.
I'm curious to know if AIDS has had any kind of purchase on the work that you do. It hasn't been mentioned, and that's not a criticism at all, but since in my own life, AIDS has been the cause of so much loss and the imaginary and the forgotten, I just wonder, has its shadow sort of receded from the work that's being done now?
No,
not at all.
Can I?
Yeah.
There's so many other elements or aspects of my thinking and my life and my activism that certainly do relate to that. And in fact, it's been a huge point of my ability to be in New York and my desire to be an artist has been affected by the communities that came before me, and a lot of work has been really explicit about that. And in a way, I can say, so no. But also, it's also sort of this thing I was talking about queer form. It's also, in a way, I could almost always call queer form also a queer kind of emotionality. And for me, that's deeply invested in the community that I was, like, born into, that I chose, which is a community that had survived AIDS, or that was still around, that was formed in that loss of a generations. And that actual relationship to becoming into something through loss has also really affected, like, some of the thinking I've done. But I'll let others respond.
Yeah, I just want to say quickly, thank you for that question, too. A lot of my inspiration for thinking about the kind of the violence of historicizing gestures comes out of actually thinking through the AIDS crisis as a really radical, unfinished history that is still kind of ongoing, but that we continually tend to think of as being past. Specifically, also in the context that I live in and engage with, where, yeah, definitely I think the AIDS crisis does not have necessarily a very clear presence in some of the queer activist communities I'm part of, because a lot of the younger kids, it's just always kind of been there. Like, that's all, like, AIDS has always been a shadow over how I've gotten to know my body, how people have gotten to know having sexual relations with people. So I think it has a different presence sometimes, but I definitely think it is, like in my work and in my writing, other than what I presented here, I work a lot on the AIDS crisis as in kind of as an unfinished history, but that one tends to want to relegate to the past in a certain way, but that one really cannot, and those kind of ghosts. And that's also, of course, Sarah Schulman's work on gentrification of the mind is, like, her concept of gentrification of the mind is an analysis of what the AIDS crisis and, like, how the AIDS crisis and gentrification as a replacement process in New York City, but also as a kind of a mental imaginary replacement process, the effects of that. So yeah, definitely it factors a lot in my work, even though it didn't today.
In the larger play, Sweet Tea, there's a whole section on HIV AIDS. And it's interesting that you posed that question, because the last time I did the show in DC, the associate artistic director, who's 28, wanted me to cut it out. Cut the HIV section out because he said it's dated. And I said, maybe for you, Missy, but not for me. So it was there and included. And I'll just say one last thing about it. That including that piece for me, you know, being coming of age in the 80s when we were just learning about AIDS, and then, you know, having close friends who I was in college with die, really encouraged me to include that part of the show, also because the men I talked to spoke about it in very elegant ways, and some who were positive, but also helped me confront demons that I hadn't been willing to deal with, and that is I never went to a funeral of any of my friends that died. And the play helped me confront that demon and own up to the fact that I had never gone. I couldn't, you know, bring myself to go to any of those funerals. And so it's very much a part of my own history, but it's also a part of my present in that I'm still losing friends. I mean, we don't think of people dying of AIDS, we think of people living with it. But, you know, just 2 weeks ago, I had a friend pass. So people are still dying.
just add like one thing. I think also there's quite a lot of younger artists today who deals with the AIDS crisis, and there's just been a really important exhibition, I think, in Toronto called Coming After, where artists, I guess you have work in it, and there are other artists here in the audiences too who have work in it, that kind of deals with younger artists or artists that came after a certain certain period of, like, that is recognized as the AIDS, or that I guess Sarah Shulman would call like the plague era. And I think like the notion of coming after is double, not like just after in time, but also kind of being after it, being invested in it, being actually really having this as something we need to deal with. And I think that, I think there are quite a lot of presence of AIDS, even though it definitely should be a lot more in any discussions.
In the back, and then we'll come forward. So I saw a hand up in the next to last row, and then we'll come to the second row.
Hi, I had just a quick question. It came up a little bit in Patrick and Emily's discussion around venue and the choice of place to display or discuss these issues. And I just wonder how some of what's been talked about today and yesterday plays out in terms of both professionalization, as Emily discussed, and institutional presentation of work. Because obviously so much of the conflict is that voices are not present in so many institutions, and so many of those voices are not getting access. But there's also the flip side of that, which gets into the professionalization discussion of there are a lot of artists who choose to opt out for very conscious reasons. So how do you both consciously opt out and also make your absence known in a powerful way?
Wow. I know, right? That's an excellent question.
You answer it.
Patrick's such a gentleman.
Because it was posted to you.
Yeah, but except over drinks, but I'm going to go ahead and think aloud now because you've pushed a lot of buttons. But this is a nice place. This is a great place. This is the best place, any place to talk about that. You know, I think it's, we're in the new museum. I've had the, privilege of being here many, many times. And I, but I also, at the beginning of my life and my career, like very specifically, created spaces to not work in institutions like this. And we stopped doing LTTR in order to not institutionalize. So that's something that I've thought a lot about, and that I've also, again, feel emotionally and feel in a dispersal of colleagues and relationships that are sustaining and where people make different decisions about what we can risk, like how we can move through, like a bar scene or queer scene, in terms of travel, just all of these things that have to be negotiated in order to prop up, let's say my life, or in order to make it personal. But I would love to think about that. I'm thinking about that. In a way, part of what I wanted to ask when I just really felt like I really needed to insert this thing about professionalization, because I've been feeling it in the last little bit, and that's that I've choose to work a lot. That's my choice. Maybe I choose to work too much. And I'm dealing with the ramifications of that, and why. Why do I do that? And how can I still be in love with my community? How can I still critique my community? How can I still be a part of something? I haven't figured that out. So I just said all that out loud. I don't know. I'll think about it. We'll talk later.
I think that for me, the work is most important, and the work has to get out in various venues. I can't just do the college circuit. Mm-hmm. Professional theater, though, has been particularly bruising to me. I don't like it. I don't like the politics of it, but I also know that the work is important to get out through that venue as well. And I have to also say that I do enjoy the kind of resources that it provides to make the work the best it can be. But also, I know that I could, you know, perform these stories, you know, at a bar or at somebody's house or, you know, in a basement somewhere, and it'd be just as effective. But for me, I think it's about getting the work to as many people as possible, because for me, these stories are so important, and it's giving voice to a population that we haven't heard from. So because they don't have the resources that I have, you know, being in a private institution, an academic institution that can, you know, provide for me to fly around the world and country. So what I can do is share their stories with folk. I'll just tell one, and it will be quick, a funny story about performing in Mobile, Alabama at the public library there. They invited me. I don't know why they invited me, but they invited me to come down, and I didn't know what the reception was going to be. And it turned out, you know, it was a mostly white audience that I'd say the average age was 70. And so I was thinking this is going to be a long show for me and for them. And what was striking about that experience, though, was afterwards during the Q&A, a minister stood up, white minister stood up, and said, "Dr. Johnson, we are so happy to have you here in Mobile, Alabama. We need to talk more about sexuality and religion, because God was there for the first wet vagina. And God was there for the first erection. And he said, it is good." So you got to take the word to the people.
You know, that's as good a place as any to end. And I know there have been someone else queued up to speak, but what's going to happen is we're going to take a quick break, we're going to reset the stage, and then there will actually be a chance for more conversation as we're wrapping up. And if this works, I'll be sending you out for the break with some negative feelings, courtesy of Stephen Sondheim and the song Happily Ever After. And since it's Sondheim, you can be sure there's a big question mark here.
Someone to hold you too close. Someone to hurt you too deep. Someone to love you too hard. Happily ever after. Someone to need you too much. Someone to read you too well. Someone to bleed you of all the things you don't want to tell. That's happily ever after. Ever, ever, ever after. In hell.